Welcome to Extreme Genes, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And welcome to Extreme Genes, America's family history show at ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. And I'm excited. Later on in the show, we're going to talk to a guy connected with a program I've heard a lot about and haven't had a lot of experience using. It's called Relative Finder. And basically, you can put in your tree with those of many other people and find out how you're related. So if you've got an office or a church group or something like that, you can put in all the names and see where these trees come together, and you can find out who within your group is related. So that should be a very interesting segment. Plus, we're going to share an Extreme Genes classic interview, my visit with Olympic champion Apollo Anton Ono, talking about his background and his search to know more. But right now, let's check in with my good friend, the chief genealogist of the New England Historic Genealogical Society and AmericanAncestors.org, David Allen Lambert. How are you, David?
Live from New York, it's your chief genealogist here in Albany.
No, Albany is not New York when you say live from New York. That's going to throw people off. What are you doing there?
Well, NEHGS every other year does a research tour to the New York State Library and Archives. So this is the week they're out here in sunny Albany, New York, and it's been really good. People are finding lots of things, but I can tell you there are some things with the old records that they don't exist anymore. Did you ever hear about the fire that happened out here?
Yeah, 1911, and of course I've dealt with that a lot because I have a lot of New York ancestry, but that fire took out some very important records.
A lot of the colonial records are completely gone, and the early Dutch records for New York, of course, were singed, but it's going to take many years of digitization and preservation to actually make them all accessible, but it's a start. I came across a database that may be very useful for people that are doing New York research. It's very hard to get records from the state, and sometimes yes. It takes up to a year to get a record. But they have just recently released the New York State Vital Record Death Index from 1957 to 1966. And on my Twitter feed, DL Genealogist, you'll find a link, and I'm sure we'll echo it for Extreme Genes. So that was exciting. But, you know, getting to family history on news, I'm going to go right on to the other side of the U.S., out to Pearl Harbor, where the remains of Albert Hayden, a former U.S. Navy veteran who perished on Pearl Harbor in December 7, 41. He was aboard the USS Oklahoma, and he is now buried beside his mom. And how they do that? DNA.
Of course.
It's amazing.
Isn't that great?
It's amazing.
You know, all the remains from the Oklahoma were kind of all together, so they buried all these people in a grave of unknowns, and now they're able to start going through and say, oh, this is this person, this is that person, and they've identified five of them so far, and it's only going to get better.
Well, that's great. I mean, we're approaching the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, and we still have a handful of the vets who are actually there. So it's kind of fitting to see their shipmates finally going home with their parents. So that's amazing. You know, getting into funerals, let's go ahead a little bit further back in time. And in 1882, the late Mary Todd Lincoln passes away, Abraham Lincoln's beloved wife. The recent acquisition and merger of the Butler Funeral Home with the Boardman Smith Funeral Home, which were both located in Springfield, Illinois, has produced a list of the funeral expenses for the late Mary Todd Lincoln.
How cool is that?
It's amazing, including the cost of the casket, which cost $225, $150 for crepe, and horse-drawn carriage for $15. Well, that's a pretty good rate, but we are talking about $1,882. So
right.
This is going to be out in a display, apparently, talking about the history of the funeral associated with the late 16th president, Abraham Lincoln.
How cool is that? That's amazing.
It really is. And, you know, I'll tell you, discoveries always turn up, and I always love to dig deep, especially when archaeological stories. So going across the pond to England, remains of the Curtin Theatre in Shoreditch, England have been recently found. And if you think of William Shakespeare, you know, it's his 400th anniversary of his death. You've got the Globe Theatre, which has been recreated on the other side of the Thames in London, and it's round.
Right.
Well, guess what? The Curtin Theatre was not round. It was rectangular. So this has thrown historians for a bit of a loop. Well, a loop, a rectangle.
A rectangle, that's right. They're going to have to redo some of their books.
I think so. Well, I mean, they're finding all sorts of artifacts. They found bone combs to clean out the little critters from your hair, and they found a lead token to pay for a pint of ale. I don't know about you, but I don't want to be handling lead than drinking or eating anything.
No kidding, huh?
That's exciting stuff that's happening. For my tech tip, and this really kind of comes down to spring cleaning, I found over 300 old canceled checks from my late mom and dad that go from the 1970s to the 1990s or so. And I was going to pitch them. Then I thought to myself, besides having their signatures, it has the counter signatures of all the people they wrote to, like checks for people who got married, flowers for funerals, or vacations we went on, or things they purchased, like maybe a bike for me. So it's really important. It kind of gives you a diary. My parents didn't keep one. So if I keep these checks in chronological order, I mean, some of them are insignificant, but it does tell a story that in some cases I forgot about.
Interesting.
It really is. That's it for me this week. I can't say signing off from Beantown, so I'll say signing out from Albany. See you next week in Beantown.
All right,
or
David.
From Beantown.
All right, and take care of those kids. It sounds like there's a lot of learning going on there.
There really is. There's a lot of school groups going through, so who knows? These are future historians and archaeologists and genealogists abounding.
All right. Talk to you next week, buddy.
Take care, my friend. Bye-bye.
And coming up next, we're going to talk about a piece of software called Relative Finder that can help you find out if you're related to lots of people. Tom Cederberg will have all the details on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show and ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth. And with over 30 years of tracing my dead, I've often found it interesting to discover that sometimes people you know, maybe somebody who lives right next door or somebody you work with, is related to you. And it's often a big surprise, but it's not that big a surprise to people like Tom Cederberg, my next guest. He is a professor of computer sciences at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. Tom, welcome to Extreme Genes.
Thank you, Scott.
I'm excited to have you on because some time back, you were the creator of a program called Relative Finder. And this program does exactly what we're talking about, helps people discover how they might be related to somebody else. This goes way back, Tom. I mean, we're talking pre-21st century.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The first version of Relative Finder was written about 1997. And I'm an avid genealogist, and I was interested in helping my neighbors get interested in family history and genealogy. And back then, this was pre-Family Search, pre-anything online. But there was a database called Ancestral File, and anybody could go to a family history library and download their genealogy from Ancestral File, assuming that they had the data in there due to the kindness of some relative who had entered it. And many of my neighbors had that, and so I went to the family history library over the course of many months and downloaded my neighbor's family history, and you know, going back 10, 12 generations. And then I helped them load it on their personal computer just to, you know, be of an assistance, because usually I've discovered if somebody just starts to play around with it, they really get hooked on it.
That's really true.
So anyway, one night I was sitting at my computer, and I said, gosh, I've got about 100 of my neighbors' data on my hard drive here. I wonder if anyone's related. And so being a computer scientist, I wrote a little computer program that would read in everybody's family tree and just compare to see if anybody had any common ancestors. And lo and behold, I was just flabbergasted. It turned out that on average, every one of those 100 neighbors of mine was related to about two-thirds of the other people. I'm talking some of them were second or third cousins. My wife turned out to have three third cousins within a block of us, and we'd lived there by then for a dozen years. She had no idea that she was so closely related to these neighbors.
Wow. That had to be quite a revelation. You know, they talk about George Herbert Walker Bush as being the first president to be related to perhaps more than half the population of America because he has early Southern roots out of Virginia and early New England roots as well.
Wow.
And that kind of gets into the bulk of the early settlers in the United States. And they were figuring he was related to about 150 million Americans.
Wow.
Yeah. And so when you break it down to the neighborhoods, I don't think most of us think that we might have somebody who's related to us just living on the same street. But I would guess that if you go back to the sixth or seventh cousin level, most of us do.
Yeah, and it's an interesting mathematical thing. I subsequently did this. I teach here at BYU, and I ran this for all of the professors in my college about 7 or 8 years ago. 180 people. We discovered 38 instances of second cousins and 160 instances of third cousins just amongst these 180 professors. It was quite fascinating.
That's incredible. This is kind of a mind blower to most people, I guess, although I think more and more people are becoming aware of the fact that the math says we really are one big family.
Yeah, we ran a probability analysis and discovered that for two random people with European ancestry, there's a 50-50 chance that they share a common ancestor within 12 generations.
That would make sense. That's going back to about the time of the Mayflower, right?
Yeah, roughly.
Somewhere in that neighborhood. In fact, I just finally found a common ancestor with my wife and myself. So we're cousins. There's anything wrong with that.
No. Just as long as it's not first cousins.
That's right. That's right. But this goes back about to the late 1500s to find one. I was really kind of surprised it took this long. So that was 1997, and then you did the thing with the professors about 8 years ago. What has happened with it since, and how can people get a hold of this, and how do they use it?
Yeah, well, since then, a lot has happened in the family history technology. To begin with, Family Search is online now. You've got Ancestry online. There's lots of companies. The appealing thing for us about Family Search is that all of their names are kind of linked together, with fairly good accuracy into one big tree, which is critical for us in order to determine how people are related.
Right.
And so anybody that has a Family Search account, and generally it's important for them to go back at least 8 or 9 generations in Family Search before they start tying into too many other people. But they can just go to relativefinder.org is our website, and it will have them log in to their Family Search account, and that's how we credential the users of Relative Finder. And it will download their, I think we're grabbing like 15 generations if they have that many, and we download that much. And then we just run a report and compare them against, we've got about 3,000 famous people, including presidents of the United States and artists and movie stars and, lots of different groups. And it'll show how they're related to these people.
And some of that will be good and some of it maybe not so much.
Exactly. Yeah, we get complaints about people. I didn't want to be related to this politician. One of the ones we get comment on a lot is we've got President Obama in the database, and a lot of people turn up being related to him, and they say, oh, that must be a mistake. They don't realize, of course, that his mother was European, and so that's how most of those relationships with him show up.
Right, because the father's side goes back to Africa immediately.
Yeah, and I don't think there's too much of his ancestry in Family Search.
Right. The mother was early American.
Yeah, I believe so.
I'm actually related to President Obama myself. Who else have you found on there that people respond to quite a bit?
Well, of course, the Mayflower people, and just got an email the other day. Somebody said they do East Coast history tours, and it's fun for them to have people do Relative Finder, and because then, they pointed out in particular, if somebody's going to visit Monticello, they can say, oh, yeah, I'm related to Thomas Jefferson or Gettysburg and so forth. So it's just makes it a lot more of a historical tie, realizing that their own ancestors played a role in some of these historical sites.
In some of the places they were actually going. Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, there's so much that goes into preparation if you're going to do a research trip somewhere, right?
Yeah.
You want to find out about the area. Where are the archives? What am I looking for? What can I order in before I even leave so I don't have to spend a lot of time there doing things that I could do from home? This is a whole other aspect of it that I would have never thought of, finding out what your relationship might be to the sites of famous individuals that you might be dropping in on.
Yeah, we have kind of a skeleton crew of students working on Relative Finder, and so it's and we're just computer scientists. We're not historians, so it's hard for us to broaden the user base of how many famous people we have in our database. But we are now soon to roll out a feature where anybody could, that might have a historical interest in a certain group of people will be able to make their own, add their own groups of famous people to Relative Finder, and that way we'll kind of crowdsource the management of it. And
interesting.
I think make it more usable for people, more interesting.
So you're developing it still to this day, and it's been 19 years. Did you ever imagine?
No, it's been very, very exciting. And we've been very fortunate. A lot of very talented computer science students have worked on it.
So tell me about some of the most incredible stories you've heard back from some of the folks who have used Relative Finder.
Yeah, well, I think my favorite quote altogether, I mean, of course, we ask, why are we going to all this work? Because it does take time and money and effort to maintain Relative Finder, and it all goes back to our passion for family history. And our favorite feedback is just people that they spend 3 minutes joining Relative Finder, and all of a sudden they're hooked on genealogy. I think my all-time favorite quote is somebody who said, "Relative Finder is the gateway drug to family history."
Did that go over well with you?
Well, you know, I don't know if I like the metaphor so much, but the sentiment was...
Well, that makes sense. You know, I was thinking about it, too, that if you're interested in, for instance, finding out if you can join the Mayflower Society, this might be a really easy way to at least see if there is some kind of path for you to find.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. And when you think about you just did this to start with your neighbors and your friends, and it's turned into this, it's got to be very satisfying, Tom.
Yeah, no, it's been very exciting. We've really just gone live with the family search version about a little over a year ago, and we're already past 500,000 users, and it grows about 20,000 users a week just by word of mouth. And so it's really drawing a lot of attention.
He's Tom Cederberg, professor of computer sciences at Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah, the creator of Relative Finder. You can sign up through your family search account. Dr. Cederberg, great to have you on the show. Thanks so much, and good luck with all the things you're doing to make this thing grow.
Thank you very much, Scott. Nice talking to you.
And coming up next, it is a classic interview, my visit with Apollo Anton Ono, the Olympic champion, about his background and what he's doing to discover more. Coming up on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here with my very special guest, Olympic multiple gold, silver medalist Apollo Ono, in studio with me today. And thanks for dropping by, Apollo. It's good to see you.
Of course, of course. I love your guys' show and what you guys do. This is awesome.
Well, thank you so much. And I was thinking about this. You're known around the world, but nobody can quite ever figure out what your background is. And obviously, you've got an interest in family history. I want to hear a little about what you've done and what you know.
Sure. I'll break it down like this. I grew up in a single-parent household. My father was Japanese. He migrated to the United States when he was 18 years old, was married to my mom, and then they got a divorce when I was very young. My father took custody of me, so he raised me my entire life. So obviously, I'm very close to my father. I don't keep in contact with my mom. So I never developed a relationship with my mother in the sense of got to know her and her background.
Right.
And my mom was actually adopted. So So she doesn't know her background and ethnicity because she doesn't know her parents. I mean, you can kind of tell based on the way they look, but because I don't keep in contact with my mom, I don't know. So when people ask me all the time, what's your background ethnicity? I say, well, I'm half Japanese. And they say, right. What's the other half? And I'm like, I don't really know. So not too long ago, I did the 23andMe genealogy test just to figure out kind of at least generally speaking what my history was. And then before that, I think there was this show called Who Do You Think You Are?
It's still around.
It's still going.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
So a friend of mine was producing the show. I had always told him, I really want to know what my background, at least on my one side, like maybe on the Japanese side, like what does it look like, the tree? Because of the half-Japanese heritage, what they did, and the Japanese keep this very strict catalog, historical documentation of where the family and clans, I guess, are from, right? Back to the samurai.
Yes.
And they started to dig deeper and deeper and deeper, and they had to get like approval from my grandmother, the time my grandfather was alive, and my father, and they were trying to just do all this research and using all these different translators, and they kept hitting a wall because it got to a point where the Japanese just didn't want to release the information. There was so much compliance and approval that my grandma was just like, I don't want to do this anymore. So I have the test results back from where I am, and it shows that the other portion of my heritage and ancestry is primarily it's northeastern European.
Okay.
Kind of like there's some Irish there, a little bit of like British, maybe some Scottish. 1.6% is North African, which I was like, wow, that's a big
Isn't that interesting when you get those trace elements?
Yeah,
those
trace elements. People always say like, what's one thing that people don't know about you, Paulo? You know, and I'm like, I don't really know. I'm pretty open about my public, you know, like who I am. And then I started thinking the other day, I was like, I do a lot of reading about some pretty obscure off-topic things. And one of them is like the origin of human species. I'm always interested in like, what was the first bones being excavated? What about this tribe? Where did we come from? You know, the other day I was reading about, you know, they found this skull and some teeth in China. And they found that this kind of predates what they normally thought of any human beings being, you know, inside China. And they found that we know what their last kind of meals were based on their teeth. I was like, how do you? That is so crazy. This is like eating like some dim sum. Like,
yeah.
This is incredible.
It's like, fantastic.
It's awesome. So really awesome.
So did you get some stories out of Japan about your parents, your grandparents, your greats? What do you know?
So on my grandmother's side, they found out that I actually have real samurai blood.
No kidding.
Real, I forgot, it was Yasunaga clan. It was something in Japan, real samurai blood. And I haven't done a lot of research into it.
When did you find that out? At what point? I mean, you were probably
not
still—
Not soon enough, because I would have used that to my advantage out there skating on these razor-sharp blades and like feeling I'm fierce.
That had to affect you. So it wasn't until after you'd retired?
Well, I tell you, it's something interesting, because my father didn't really play sports. My grandfather didn't really play sports. My grandmother didn't really play sports. And so I have this like really unique athletic ability that was sort of an anomaly in my family. But there has to be some genetic heritage that is passed down through generations. We found that there's a relative in my family who was an exceptional runner, but never in a competition setting. But he would go visit his wife, and back then, you know, years and years and years ago, he would run to go see her, and it was like 16 miles one way or something.
Wow!
Crazy. So he was like, it's incredible endurance athlete.
Well, you must have drawn something from him.
And then, you know, perhaps from the samurai bloodline, maybe there's some fighter mentality there that is, you know, at least I like to think so.
Absolutely. You know? So you found out about the samurais. How far back are we talking here?
I don't know the exact date period, but it's pretty far back. I think we're going into like, you know, the 1400s, 1300s time. So this is pretty far back.
And did you get some of your tree back that far? Or?
A little bit. It's bits and pieces, and some of it's broken because they were not able to really connect properly given the approval inside Japan.
So right, right.
It's going to take for me to fly to Japan with my grandmother and then like basically just say, all right, Oba-chan, I need you to kind of agree to this.
So you need certain approvals from within the family.
Every single step needs approval. Yeah, it's very cumbersome.
Wow.
And so she was just like, why does he have to know? It doesn't really matter.
We're talking to Olympic hero and idol Paulo Ono about his family history background and some of his research. And you were saying you did the 23andMe DNA test. And since your mother's side was adopted, did you find any cousins, first of all? Did you find any connection with some folks who might be cousins to help you open up that adopted side?
Not yet. But there's been like some, I think they give you like some suggestions, right? In terms of like who might possibly be related. I always wondered why my goatee and my sideburns were red. Because Japanese people have black hair.
Yeah, that wouldn't be from there.
And I'm like, I'm either Irish or like Native American.
Scottish, yeah.
Scottish, mm-hmm. Definitely something in the northeastern European region.
Sure.
And it makes sense now.
Well, a lot of people will do that. They'll suddenly find a first or second cousin pops up or even a third.
Right.
And then they can start coming down and to what you know about your mother and start putting this thing together, reconstructing the tree coming forward. And that's how that can get done.
Yeah.
But you're going to have to be paying attention to your results in order to get that to happen.
It takes work, right? So you have to kind of sit down and you have to be committed and really kind of see.
Well, and like you say, you've got that natural curiosity about history and a human factor. I mean, this is something you can do on the plane on your handheld device.
That's what I do. It's on the plane. I do it on the plane. Yeah.
Yeah, all over the place. So what are you doing now?
So, you know, I retired in 2010 from my pursuit of the Olympic Games.
You miss it?
Every day. I miss the Olympic space every single day. But I get a taste of it every couple of years when I go to the Olympic Games. You know, I'm an NBC correspondent for the Olympics. I will be in the Rio 2016 Olympic Games as a commentator. I'll be in the 2018 Games as a commentator. I'll be in the 2020 Games as a commentator, 22 and 24 and beyond. So that's what I do in relation to sports. Then I have my own serial entrepreneurial activities that I kind of focus
sure.
on. I do some, you know, hosting and some acting based in Los Angeles. But those three are the main things that I really spend my time in, and obviously the Special Olympics and other different types of organizations that I've become partners with and try to lend my time to. So,
love the Special Olympics.
Yeah, phenomenal.
I remember the
phenomenal.
First time I was ever asked to host some event there. And I went there, frankly, with kind of a bad attitude.
Yeah.
It was like, it was a Saturday, and it's like, oh, I got to go host this other thing.
Yeah.
And I got down there, and it was the most fulfilling, heartwarming thing. And I drove home with just such a glow. And I was thinking back about how I had felt coming down and how I felt. And I couldn't do enough of that stuff for many years to come. And it was just a joy to do it. And I can see you feel the same way about it.
Yeah, it's
a revelation.
You think it's a giving experience, but you get so much in return. And that's what I try to tell people is, look, just try it. Just see what I'm talking about. I can't explain it to you.
And the love.
The love is so genuine.
Yes.
I mean, the Special Olympics athletes are so incredibly special, and they're just unique. And I love being part of the organization, blessed to be able to represent them and always kind of take part. It's been a big part of my life, you know, excited about it.
Apollo Ono, thank you so much for your time, and good luck in your pursuit.
Thank you. Thank you
so much. Because I know this is going to be something that's going to keep pulling you back, especially when you got all those samurais back there yelling at you, you know.
They learn more about us.
Absolutely. Well, don't athletes ultimately use things like anything they can use as a motivation, right?
Yep. Yep.
Some kind of slight, like the Koreans did with you.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah, I was their motivation.
Yes, you were.
Their single song. Oh, man. Yeah.
He's Olympic legend Apollo Ono on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. It's preservation time at Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com, our preservation authority. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Super.
All right. What do you got for us today?
Okay, we've got some updates. We've talked a lot about storage devices. People are still asking us questions about storage. And we have an update. We've always talked about thumb drive technology. People call them different things, but basically, there's something about the size of your thumb.
Right.
Now they have them in shapes of credit cards. They have them in shapes of cars. They have them in shapes of about anything that you want.
Yeah, I had a cruise ship one once.
That's cool.
It's great.
And, you know, there's a lot of different ones out there on the market. Some of them come pre-packed with information, and you plug it in. It's, you know, goes to their website or has information about whatever when they're handing them out at trade shows. The one thing you have to be really careful with is you have to make sure you get some really good quality ones, because there's a lot of junky ones coming out of China that, you know, I wouldn't take if they gave them to me for free. But there's newer technology that makes them better. Always check the warranty, like the ones that we sell in our store, and we put like MP3s and 4s on. And in fact, some of them that are like 18 gig and 32 gigs, we can actually put, you know, entire DVDs on them.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh, it's incredible. And the ones that we have a one-year warranty on them. So if anything ever happens in your first year, which is usually when they're going to go bad, they're covered. And these new ones that I really like, they're like, you know, the rubber wristbands you wear for, like, you know, Be Strong or different things like
sure,
this.
Sure, for racing, yes.
Yeah, all different kinds of little rubber bands. There's one out there now that's like that. It just, when you plug it together, it makes a wristband. So they're so convenient. They're smart. You can put on your key ring because it'll snap together. But like I say, they're about the size of your wrist. And the technology on these ones is getting so much better. However, we still want to give you the caveat. You need to make sure if you're using thumb drives, use it as a transfer system to go from something to something else. In fact, even if you have the best one ever created that's never going to give you a problem, what if you lose it?
Oh, yeah. There's no question. The thing is, it's interesting, is I've had one for years, the same one, and it works great. And I use it for transferring material when I'm in a research center or a library, and I can bring it home and it's no problem. But it's still all there and it's never failed me. But I have seen so many of these cheap ones, you wonder, why would anybody ever rely on a thumb drive as their permanent storage solution?
Oh, exactly. You look at the big people like Facebook and people like that. They don't store all their stuff on thumb drives. They store it on, you know, Blu-ray discs and such. So what's so convenient about these things is that they are so portable. Like we say, you always want to have stuff backed up on a disk, preferably a Tyoyuden disk or even an M disk, which are the ones that are 1,000-year disks. You want to make sure it's in the cloud, and two clouds, if you can afford it, make sure both clouds are unrelated, like for instance, Google Drive and Apple or Dropbox or one of these kind of things. If you use somebody like ours, we have our own, but ours is actually built on Google. So if you use Lightjar, which we have, you know, you don't want to have Lightjar and Google as your two, because basically they're the same thing. We just build the infrastructure on top of it. So you want to make sure they're not related, and you always want to put stuff on a hard drive. And the price of hard drives are coming down and down and down. I mean, you know, I saw Best Buy, they had, I think there was a 1 terabyte hard drive for like $50 the other day.
No kidding, really?
It's just amazing. And I remember when a 500 gigabyte was $150. So the prices are coming down, and they're small and they're portable, and that's a good way to store stuff. It's an excellent way to ship stuff. If you want to ship stuff to us to have somebody work on it or ship it to somebody else, a family member, those drives are so inexpensive. It's a great way to store stuff.
I never thought I'd hear you suggest maybe we could ship something to you on a thumb drive.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, like I say, things are changing. It's, you know, the wave of the future. The nice thing about thumb drives, like I say, they're so small, but always back it up. Don't send anything to us or anybody if you don't have it backed up. You know, if you think, oh, I don't need a copy of this, I'm going to send it to Aunt Martha. No, you want to make sure you have a copy of it.
It's preservation time. We're talking to Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com, and we've been talking thumb drives because, let's face it, Tom, historically, they're pretty trashy storage items.
Exactly.
And now, finally, some people are getting around to making some real good ones. And you didn't mention in the previous segment, how much are these new ones going to set us back?
You know, this is what's really surprising is they're so inexpensive. In our store, we carry 16 gigabyte and 32 gigabyte, which are awesome ones, and they're under $10.
Wow, that's great. And,
oh,
they'll,
yeah.
And they'll last.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, like I say, we have a one-year warranty on them. If anything goes wrong, I don't care what it is, send it back to us. We'll send you a new one.
But how long do you actually expect it to last?
You know, just like you said in the earlier segment, I've got one that's hanging on my keychain that I have had for at least 10 years. And every time I think, oh, this is going to be the day it goes away. This is going to be the day it goes away. I back it up and everything. And it's still screaming along. I've never had a problem with it. Now, one thing you want to be careful with, we talked about different shapes. Like there's one that's like a credit card. The reason I would say kind of steer away from that one is because look at the credit cards in your wallet. They're probably kind of half-mooned by now.
Right, yes.
And so what's that going to do to the circuitry? You know, a magnetic stripe isn't as volatile as a circuitry in a USB drive. So you want to be careful. And you talked about small ones. We had somebody bring in one the other day that was the size of your thumbnail. Not your thumb, but your thumbnail.
Your thumbnail. Wow.
Exactly. She hands it to me, and I'm sitting there waiting for her. She says, what do you need? I go, well, here's the cap. Where's the USB? She says, that's it. There's this little teeny cap on it. It's a quarter of an inch, and you pop that off. I thought, I wouldn't have those if they were free. How easy is that to lose? Or when your little kids could swallow it, and there goes all your stuff.
Well,
stay away from those things. Think, what am I going to use this for? If it's a one-time thing, you're going to load something, send it off, and you don't care about it, that's fine. But if you're going to keep it, have it, you know, something at least the size of your thumb, and make sure you don't ever leave it in your pocket. We've had people send them through the washing machine, and sometimes we've been able to recover them. Sometimes we haven't. That's why I really, really like these new neoprene wrist kinds. They're easy to keep track of. If you're out in the rain, it's not going to ruin them. They're just a great way to go, and they're under $10, so it's absolutely amazing with them.
Now, they'll last longer if you don't use them a lot, right? So if you wanted to store them, say you wanted to store some MP4s or MP3s, and you load them up there and just put them on a shelf somewhere, those should last for quite a while, right? That
oh,
way,
yeah.
Because you're not using them.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's true. The biggest thing about using them is not just the using them. It's, you know, as you know, they slide in tight, and you pull them out so they don't fall off. And so it's just the pushing in and pushing out and pushing in and pushing out is a problem. And one thing I really want to emphasize a lot is always make sure when you put them in your computer, don't ever pull it out without shutting down your computer or making sure you've released it.
Right.
And whether you're a PC or a Mac, it's come on and told you, okay, it's safe to remove it now. If you're not sure, if you think, oh, I don't know if this is released wrong, shut down your computer and take it off, because that's usually when they get messed up. Because you might be all done adding stuff to it, but maybe your computer is still accessing it because it's looking for information or whatever, and you pull it out right in the middle of one of those times, that's where you're going to totally corrupt all the stuff that's on it. So most important thing is careful putting it in, careful removing it. But these new ones are great. The neoprene are great because, you know, they're a lot more water resistant than the other kind, and they'll probably have a better chance of going through your washer if that does happen.
Ooh. Don't even talk like that.
It's scary.
Thanks for coming on, Tom. See you next week.
See you then.
Hey, that wraps it up for this week. Thanks once again to Dr. Tom Cederberg from Brigham Young University. He's a computer sciences professor who created a little program called Relative Finder years and years ago, and they're still improving it to this day. It's a way for you to find out who you're related to who's famous or who you're related to who lives just down the street. It's a great interview. If you missed it, catch the podcast on iTunes, iHeartRadio's Talk Channel, and ExtremeGenes.com. Hey, next week, we'll talk to a man who, as a young Cub Scout, got to visit with the last living Civil War soldier. Wow, what was that about? Find out next week on the show. Thanks for listening. Talk to you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.